Hey, how's it going? It's August. Yes, August episode of Breakpoint. It was funny. Again, we're in summer mode and we're just like, yep, it's time to learn something new. So I'm like, hey, Paul, what is the one thing that you don't know about Visual Studio that we could teach everybody?
Yeah.
And he's kind of like humming and humming because obviously he knows everything about Visual Studio.
No, I don't. Nobody knows everything about Visual Studio.
Just being modest. But anyway, so this is how we actually get to today's show, the role of the architect.
Yeah.
And one of the things that always gets me about architecture in Visual Studio is that it's such an unknown feature of Visual Studio that,
yeah,
like, think about it. Every development team, in theory, has an application architect.
Even if it's that person isn't called an architect,
right,
there's somebody that has to design the system.
I was getting to that. Someone's going to design it. So if it's an application architect, or many of you as developers will most likely at some point double as an application architect.
Yep.
Right? And so everybody, whenever they talk about Visual Studio, there's always this talk about code. And it's always code, code, code.
Yep.
And every once in a while, you talk about class diagrams or whatever.
Yep.
But there are actual architectural tools in Visual Studio.
Yeah.
Surprisingly, that nobody knows about.
Exactly.
So that's what we're going to talk about today. And remember, this is live. So if you have any questions, feel free to post them into the chat. We'll take them as we go. And more importantly, if you're seeing this on demand afterwards, keep those questions coming. Either post it right underneath the video if you're watching it on Channel 9, or same thing if you're watching it on YouTube.
Yeah, because we'll answer those questions as they come along too. Yeah.
Right. And hopefully, because when we did the research, I shouldn't even say we, when Paul did the research for doing this show, there wasn't really much out there, right?
It's funny, you know, like I was actually quite surprised as well. Just there isn't a whole lot of buzz around some of these tools, and it's unfortunate because I think they're actually pretty cool.
Yeah.
And even if you're not an architect, if you're an aspiring architect and you want to get into the design of your system, there's some really interesting things as part of Visual Studio that can really help you understand how software is built, first of all, but also really help you and your team understand how the software is being built.
Yes.
So there's lots of goodness around a lot of those different things, and we'll talk a little bit about that and show some of this stuff as well.
Cool. So then Paul's going to guide you through a little bit of an intro. You're going to see me looking just a little bit off there so that I'm going to make sure to get out his screen on the screen for you, but I'm not ignoring you guys. All right? So,
no, he's not.
They're all yours, and I will be back shortly, even though you still see me.
Okay, so maybe we'll just go quickly to the slide, just because I want to do a little bit of an introduction here. And it's funny, because I look back at my career, and I'm going to be dating myself a little bit here, but when I graduated from university, so I'm an alum of University of Ottawa, go Garnet and Gray, But back in 1996, it was when I graduated from computer science at University of Ottawa, and my first job out of school was with a consulting company out in the Maritimes. So those of you that are not from Canada, the Maritimes are basically the eastern provinces, and specifically I was out in St. John, New Brunswick, doing some work for a consulting company out that way, and I was put on a project for one of the telephone companies out that way. And it was my first real sort of introduction into business IT in a lot of ways, right? And building systems for businesses and things. And it's funny because I was put on a team that was fairly large, but at the same time it was a close-knit team. And part of the reason for that was there was a really good understanding of roles and responsibilities on the team. So me as a junior developer learning first of all how to do VI with C and C++ on Solaris, which was awesome. I loved it. But there was some really cool things that I noticed that were beyond just the technology and the coding components of it. And that was really the dynamic of the team. And you might be wondering why I'm asking about or talking about this, because we're talking about Visual Studio and some of the features down the road. But I really did want to talk to you a little bit about about what was going on with the team itself. And there were two people in particular that really sort of took me under their wing and really helped me learn the business, if you will. And those were two of the architects on the team. They were application architects. One of them, his name was Jeff McHugh, and the other one, his name was Derek Ellingwood. And the reason why I know these people's names, 20 years almost after the fact, is because of the fact that they really taught me what it was to be a system professional or a coding professional or really building software. And it was interesting because the role of an architect is a unique one within the whole business of software overall. JR, you're probably the same way. I mean, you probably have seen this as well, right?
Yep.
The architect, and specifically, there's different types of architects. There's enterprise architects, there's data architects, there's infrastructure architects, there's application architects and things.
Solution architects,
which I kind of, you're right. Solution architects are a little bit different than an enterprise architect. But, everybody has different names for these things. But the application architects are really interesting because they are, I shouldn't even say that. All the architects are interesting because they bridge the speak or the terminology, and they bridge the understanding between what the business wants and what the technology needs to actually implement it. They're almost translators in a way. And it's a really tough skill to understand. It's a really tough skill to master. And the really, really good ones know when to listen. Mm. And they know when to act, right? And that was one of the things that I found was really, really interesting. And it's an ongoing process, right? At Microsoft, we're all about continual improvement. And, what did you do great? But let's talk about the things that you think you can do better next time, right?
It was very managerial of you.
Well, I guess maybe that's the architect in me at
there
one point or other.
But it's all coming out. That's why he wanted to do this show.
Yeah, really, right? But the reason why it's so impactful to me is because I learned more from these individuals in that first 2 years that I was actually working on this project than I can say I've learned from other people in that same amount of time in other spots. And it's nothing to do with the fact that these other individuals that I've worked with as well didn't add value. That's not the case. It's just these two individuals, they understood the business, but they understood the technology. And they helped me understand the business side of things, which was really interesting. And, even their mannerisms and the questions that they asked within meetings and things like that were really, really, really insightful. And they obviously added value to every single meeting that they were in, as well as their day-to-day, activities and things like that on the project. So that's just an ode to the architect and why it's so important. The other thing that was really interesting was further along down the road in my career, I was sort of a project manager of architects, which was kind of an interesting sort of role because I was working down in the U.S. for this specific project, and I was leading a team of architects across various different parts of a system that we were building down in Pennsylvania. And I had an epiphany as part of this process that was really, really interesting. So we had the development leads in a room alongside my team, which was a team of architects. And the lead architect as part of that, his name was Rob Devlin. And, a very interesting guy. He's a musician as his first love, but he loves software as well. And it's kind of interesting the way he sort of took a look at things. And when we were doing this meeting, this was sort of a kickoff meeting around, okay, well, we understand that there's some things that we need to do to augment a new system. So we're actually building some things around single sign-on. And at the time, there weren't really very many good package solutions around single sign-on and federated authentication and things like that. And instead, what it was we had to figure out exactly how we were going to do this. So all the dev leads and myself and everybody else were going, okay, well, we need this feature, and this is how we're going to do it and things like that. And then Rob's just sitting there, and he's just like this, and this was a mannerism he had all the time. He was like, mm-hmm. 20 minutes of this, and then he said, okay, everybody just stop. And so everybody stopped in the meeting because when he speaks, it's actually something that everybody stops to listen because he knows what he's doing. And he said, why are you making this so complicated? This is easy. We need to make sure that all the systems that we've already built alongside other systems that might be built down the right way or integrated into the solutions that we built need to sign on with a single identity. So let's start with the very simple things. And he just got up to a whiteboard, kind of like the one you see in the background, and he built a UML model with actors and activities and all these various different things. And this isn't the model he built, this is just me being stupid.
I was gonna say, I'm like, that's, I don't know how much productivity you're gonna get out of these guys.
No. But the interesting thing around this was, it just made me learn again, or relearn even, if you will, the value of simplicity. And just because a system is complicated in its, you know, underpinnings doesn't mean that conceptually it has to be complicated. And
Sure. So
the two things that I guess I'm getting from this little monologue or this little soapbox rant that I have is architects are important.
Yes, they are. And
they're important because they are translators from the business to the technology, and they keep things as simple as they need to be.
Ideally.
And I think that is really the role of an architect in a lot of ways.
Yeah, or at least that's the way that it should be. Right? Because a lot of times, I shouldn't even say a lot of times, but at times what happens is that because one would think if there are too many people on a team, things kind of get interesting. But it's really important to understand that that role is really, not only is it a design role and a moderator role and a bridge role, like that's the value of the architect, at least I think.
Yeah.
And back in the day when I was doing application architecture as well, I mean, once the development gets going, you know, you don't really have that active role other than making sure that it actually sticks to designs. But what you're spending more time is making sure that everybody's on the same page, talking the same language, doing all that kind of stuff. So
exactly.
I agree. Architects are important. And it looks like from the chat they agree as well.
Yeah, and I mean, if you are an architect today, definitely put that in the chat window or whatever if you're watching this on in the live format, because I'd be very curious to see how many people live are actually watching this that are actually in an architect role, whether it's official or non-official.
Yeah, it looks like we have solution architects, we have enterprise architects, application architects. There's a debate on cloud architects.
You know what? That's interesting, because a cloud architect could be a solution architect, but it's a very, very different type of solution architect than we've known in the past.
Yep. So and by the way, actually, Paul and I are seeing this as a trend coming up right now where that's more and more in demand these days, especially as a lot of solutions that are built these days are going to the cloud. There is that necessity for someone who actually understands cloud both from an architecture perspective and a development perspective.
Yep.
I don't know that you're necessarily going to see job postings out there for cloud architects, but...
I wouldn't be surprised if you do. We actually have a title called cloud architect inside our walls, yeah.
Okay, well, see, there you go. You guys learned something new, I learned something new.
Yeah, and it's funny, right? You know, speaking of the cloud, and I'll just go a little bit further on this, is it's interesting because the architect role is really important, especially if you're moving to the cloud. Again, trying to keep things simple and understand the needs of the business in addition to what the technical limitations or the technical requirements might be around actually moving existing applications to the cloud or even building new applications.
Sure.
You know, everything else like that. It's kind of interesting. And in fact, you know, when we talk about even internally within sales, the sales teams and things like that, we say, and if you're familiar with our cloud offering, it's basically Microsoft Azure is our cloud platform. But basically, it's funny, we say, don't ever, ever go to the customer and sell them Azure because they don't care about Azure. And neither do the cloud architects. They care about the solution built on top of it.
Right.
So again, that's trying to abstract it from a product to an actual business need and translating that into a technology.
So now in theory, in order to be productive, right, in order to be as efficient as possible in that role, obviously then just like developers have development tools, architects need their respective tools as well.
Good segue. Absolutely. So let's get to it. Right?
I was just going to say, I'm like, well, you know, I had to think about that one a little bit, but that went over well.
It was a reach, but it worked. Yeah. So. And to that point now is, yes, we talked about this before. We actually have tools that can help you, intrepid architect, with building your systems within Visual Studio. If you're using .NET, they're very well integrated into that. But even if you're not using .NET, like if you're a Java developer, true, we don't have Java support within Visual Studio per se, but you can still create your architectural assets, including diagrams and things like that, and save those into source code repositories and things like that as well. So just because you're not necessarily using .NET doesn't mean that you can't use Visual Studio for some of these architecture tools as well. So just be aware of that. So with that, I'm going to go through some of the capabilities that we have within Visual Studio around the architecture components, and I'll demo some of these things as well, just so you know it's not going to be complete slideware. But there's some really interesting things around this, and one of the things is code maps. Now, code maps are really useful because it allows you to sort of figure out exactly what capabilities or which components of your solution exist, first of all, because sometimes, especially as solutions get larger and you add new pieces in and things like that, it gets very difficult to understand how these things actually work together. So as you can see sort of here on the screenshot that we have here in a debugging format, but it's beyond debugging as well, is the fact that you can see all the various different components that are interacting with each other at any one given point within the software. And this is dynamically created. You can save it if you want. You can email it to others and things like that as well. So it's a very, very interesting way to find out real-time information about how your code actually interacts with other code and things. So there's that. Around that, we also can see things around relationships. Well, here's the navigating code component here that I mentioned. But understanding relationships, right? So how does one sort of method work with another method, or, you know, different properties within classes and things like that work with each other? And there's different ways that you can sort of manage these things. You can see, for example, all the various different sort of arrows that are associated with this. It's very, very dynamic. Like I said, it generates from the code in this case. So you can find out right away exactly what's going on. So that's actually quite interesting. Beyond that, you can see things such as, it's actually quite interesting to see around, finding problems, because sometimes when you're in the weeds of it as a developer, for example, it might be very difficult for you to find out where something is going wrong. So in this case, for example, there's an example of, somebody's creating a paint application. And when you actually try to do an undo, it doesn't do anything. So you find out, okay, well, why is not undo actually changing anything on the screen? In this case, maybe it's because, well, the arrow that you see with the question mark there, maybe this doesn't actually exist within this specific diagram, but maybe it should exist, right? So basically what you find out graphically, instead of actually going into the code itself, is saying, well, the undo doesn't actually call the repaint function or method. So therefore, even though you've undone the change that you made, it doesn't actually repaint the screen, so it's actually not reflected on the screen itself. So that's just a simple example of some of these things that can really, really help. And then beyond those types of things, you can share it, as I said before, right? So there's all sorts of different capabilities around sharing these diagrams that are created dynamically and things like that. You can save it and put it into source code management if that's something that you want as well. So there's lots of great capabilities there. And as you can see, there's a whole bunch of things around color coding and things like that. And again, we'll show you some of this stuff as well.
I was actually just putting that into the chat that one of my personal favorites of the code maps, not only is the emailing part, but actually being able to annotate right into it with the color coding and stuff like that. And to me, again, talking about that productivity and that being efficient from a communication perspective, back in the day when I was doing this, we were doing this in Visio, which is a different story altogether.
Yeah, did that
right?
too.
But we had to copy it into Outlook as an email. We had to send it.
Yeah.
You would talk back and forth, and then everybody would sort of kind of have to try and figure out how it is or what part of the code you're actually talking about, because there's no reference to it.
Exactly.
Now it's all one and the same.
Yeah.
And so you think about it, it doesn't sound like that big of a deal, but those are minutes for each person that you're saving, which ends up coming up to a whole bunch of time.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's real time, right? And I mean, it's, you use Visio, or I've used PowerPoint as well for some of these things in the past as well. I mean,
PowerPoint for code?
Not for code, but for these types of diagrams.
I was going to say, I'm like...
Yeah, no. but the thing was, it doesn't matter, right? Visio, PowerPoint, they're all great tools for various different things. And even if they're completely accurate, they're a point-in-time snapshot.
Right.
Right. So as the code changes, those things get outdated really, really quickly. And it's a lot of effort to make sure that those things are maintained. Doing stuff like this within the tool itself that can actually scan the code and find out those relationships for you on the fly, maybe a better solution for you. Okay, the other thing that we'll talk about is something called the Architecture Explorer. So this is a component that's built in. It's one of the windows within options within Visual Studio that allows you to really sort of dig deeper into your code, in a hierarchical fashion. So for example, you can see here, here's an example of what it might look like, and I'll show you a little bit of the Architecture Explorer as well. But you can see there's a whole bunch of different sort of hierarchies that you have here, right? So you can see, for example, you start off with your solution, which is a typical asset within Visual Studio. And then you can take a look at class views, solution views, file system. So you can even add new files or, from the file system if best you want. And from there, it can find out exactly, okay, well, what are the namespaces that you're using, right? So right away, you get a full view of exactly what are the various different namespaces that are within your solution. Then you can drill down into the nodes, into the classes, into the methods, into the properties, all those types of things. So it's infinitely scalable that way so that you can actually find out what exactly is within your solution. So if you're looking for a specific component of your solution and you know the name of it, for example, yeah, you can search within Visual Studio from a universal perspective and you'll get to the code, but this might give you a little bit more of a quicker way of handling some of this stuff as well. And as you can see, there's filters and things like that that allow you to do your searches in there as well. And then beyond that, you can also see, for example, you know, all the various different sort of where places that, you know, various namespaces or classes or where they're being referenced within the actual code itself. So you can actually get and navigate right to the code where these things are very, very quickly as well, which is very, very helpful in a lot of ways if you think about it, right? Because again, the intent here is, you know, as an architect or as a developer or whatever that you're trying to, the role that you're in, finding out what you need to find out quickly is an improvement in productivity, and obviously that helps out everybody in the end as well. And I talked already about filter and search, so you can do that, so there's full search capability within this that allows you to do those types of things. And then beyond that, you can actually create diagrams based on the fly, right? So as you get closer and closer into the architecture, you can actually select assets within each of these columns, for example, and say, okay, well, right click on this and say, well, I want to create code map for this right from this area. So you can actually be very selective as to the scope of your code maps as well. So, you know, you can do a full architectural review of your solution and create the code map from there, or you can actually select assets from the code itself, like a class or, you know, a namespace, and find out exactly how the various different components within that namespace actually interact as well. All right, so the next component are the UML modeling tools. And if you're not familiar with UML, it's pretty much the de facto standard for modeling within architectural context. So unified modeling language, it was built, I don't even know when it was built, maybe in the 80s, 90s?
Yeah, but I mean, there have been couple of subsequent versions of
it, course, right?
So we're on what?
4.0 or something like that.
Yeah, wow, do I feel old all of a sudden. When I was doing UML, it was UML 2.0.
Yeah, it's been around. And it's interesting, right? Because the UML is a really good skill to know. And I'm just going to say that because I know for a fact that it's helped me in my career. And it's very, very important for you to understand what some of these diagrams might look like, right?
So that's UML-ish.
Ish. It's not...
Ish.
It's
certainly not
liberties.
Standard.
I took liberties, but you know...
It's okay, you're allowed.
Yeah, exactly. But just a recommendation on books. There's a great book by Grady and Booch.
Yes.
By the UML modeling language. And there's a subsequent book that's sort of more of an application of it. So there's... I have both of the books, and they're great. They're not exactly riveting reads because they're textbooky, but if you want to know anything about UML, I would definitely take a look at the Grady and Booch manuals because they are the best places. Kind of like if you want to learn C, you go to the Kernighan and Ritchie C handbook. That's just what you do.
Right? And for those of us that don't do books, because we're a little bit more modern, see here,
books are never going to go away.
If you're looking for online resources, there's actually great UML stuff right on the Visual Studio Developer Center.
Yeah.
There's a lot of UML stuff there too, which is really good.
Absolutely. Yep. So, yeah. So lots of opportunities, lots of options for you. Definitely take advantage of it. So the modeling tools, so what you see here is a screenshot of the modeling templates that are available within Visual Studio. So you see here, for example, you have UML class diagrams, sequence diagrams, use case, activity, component, layer diagrams, which are really, really cool, and I'll explain those in a bit as well as directed graphs and things. So this is like you can go file new project and create a new project. You can add them into your solutions and link them into your code and all those types of things as well. So this is all basically integrated in, or they can be standalone. So like in the case of, say, for example, like I said, if you're doing Java or non-.NET sort of language development, unfortunately, because of the fact that Visual Studio is really around, .NET and unmanaged C or C++, for example, you're really looking at code integration on that level. But if you're not using those languages, you can still create standalone projects that can help you with this stuff. And it's got a lot of great features that would make it very, very much interesting to you as well. So for first example here, is the use case diagram. So this is, you know, an example of the Dinner Now system, which you may be familiar with. It's one of the reference architectures that we have around around Visual Studio and .NET, so you can actually take a look at that. So it's pretty typical UML, nothing too wild about that. And then you also have activity diagrams, so you know who's doing what and when, right? So just gives you a little bit of the swim lanes, as you can see right there, all the various different components of it, as well as all the various different activities. You can create those on the fly. Very, very useful for really understanding exactly when things happen and why they happen, for example, and all the interactions in between. Then, of course, your typical class diagrams. I don't think there's much to be said about that. I mean, it's a class diagram.
What can I say about
class? Well, yeah, I mean everybody sort of, well, yeah, I guess, right? I mean, it is what it is. But it's, you know, everybody needs class diagrams if you're doing object-oriented programming, and most people are doing that today. So if you're not familiar with class diagrams, probably time to get with it and get into that. But it is something that we do provide full capabilities on as well.
Well, actually, if you're not doing object-oriented programming, I want to hear from you on the chat.
Well, there's good reasons why you wouldn't.
I wasn't suggesting otherwise. Yeah. I was just saying if someone is not doing that, I want to hear from you.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I still love C, and C is not object oriented, you know. So I'm a big fan.
We're not getting into this battle. I don't know if you guys know, but I'm a big fan of C sharp.
And then I love C sharp too.
Every time it's we get into this, he focuses on like performance and stuff like that. And I'm like, but C sharp is so much prettier.
Oh, is this a conversation that we had on email yesterday?
Yes. Yes. Absolutely. Right. Yes. I'm not bashing performance. I'm not bashing anything. You know, to me, and I'm sure to you guys as well, code is art. And yes, I realize I'm geeking out, but code is art. Therefore, it should be pretty, and therefore, I'm a C-sharp fan because it's prettier.
I'm a big fan of C-sharp. Don't get me wrong. It's my main programming language, but there's always a place in my heart for C and assembly. I don't know why.
Fair enough.
All right. So component diagrams, again, not really much to say here other than the fact that, yeah, obviously, we support it within Visual Studio. Component object model and, you know, COM and all that kind of stuff still exists. In fact, it had quite a resurgence with Windows 8 coming out, for example. But beyond that, even, you know, like creating components and, you know, interfaces between, you know, different pieces of software. So iUnknown and iQueryable and all those types of things, if you're familiar with those, it's all there. But so if you need to create component diagrams, absolutely can do that. And it is integrated into .NET and unmanaged C++ within Visual Studio as well. And then the thing that actually doesn't seem to get a lot of attention, but I think it's actually very valuable, especially obviously if you're using our source code repository capabilities around Team Foundation Server, we can actually do things right from the diagram for creating work items, whether that's, as you can see right here, a bug or a requirement or a work item, a test case, whatever it is that you want to do, right from there. So that integration, you know, like we talk, if you've seen any other of the Breakpoint episodes that I've had before, I talk an awful lot about the fact that we got a full end-to-end sort of solution around application lifecycle management. And this is one component or one area that, and I think it's actually very, very powerful that, you know, you can take these diagrams, take a look at how the interactivity happens between them. Find out maybe there's a gap in a test case or something like that because maybe you've added some capabilities from the diagram and say, well, we need some coverage on this. And yeah, okay, you can get code coverage from unit tests and stuff like that to find out exactly if you're covered that way. But, you know, manual test cases. This, for example, if you see here the actor and the various different sort of activities or verbs, if you will, associated with it, you can actually create test cases, for example, right from the diagram itself. It'll set up a new template for you so you can actually add those into TFS and you can track upon those things as well. Very powerful, very, very powerful. All right, layer diagrams. I'm actually a big fan of these things because of the fact that I think they provide you with a lot of value right from the get-go. And as an architect, one of the things that I spent a lot of time doing, especially in that Pennsylvania project that I talked about, is making sure that developers didn't do something they weren't supposed to do. And I'm not saying that because developers inherently try to do bad things. That's the case.
Did you just go there?
I did, but it's not
the chat's going to go all crazy in a second.
It's not that. It's just because sometimes, as a developer, you're trying to get work done.
Yes.
And maybe you make a call to a specific component, and you're not really thinking about the architectural considerations because maybe you're a level below that, and you don't really worry about that stuff. You just have a set of requirements that you're building to.
Right.
Especially as the systems get more complex, and we talk about architects removing complexity. Some things just are complex. You make a call from one method to another method, and you think you're doing the right thing, but it may actually break some architectural rules that you've actually have within the project. And it's kind of tough to figure out what those rules that are broken right away.
Right, because at times you have it, you're going to think, it might just be the one step down, but it actually might have consequences further down the line. Because it's, and especially if you're working on a larger team, it may not actually even be something that you're working on that has a downstream effect on someone else. You wouldn't know it.
Exactly.
Because it's not in your realm of code.
You got it.
Right? It's a bit different when you're working on it by yourself.
But yep.
Then again, these tools are inherently built for teams, which you can obviously always use on your own, but are meant for teams.
Yeah, exactly, right? So here we have a screenshot of what a layer diagram looks like. And this was a layer diagram that you create, you drag and drop. And as you probably imagine, especially if you're familiar with architecture and N-tier architecture, there's obviously various different components of a system, right? So you have, the client side might be the browser, it might be a WPF legacy desktop application, or maybe even it's a Windows Store or Android app or whatever. Right, those types of things. And then you have the server side. So you have different layers, as you can sort of see right here, right? So you have the web server, you have a data access layer, and then you have database side things. So you can find and you can create these things, and then what you can do is you can drag and drop code methods into this to say, okay, well, this method belongs in this part of the thing. So if you say, for example, I bring my mouse up, the company.web area. So maybe you have a component that's associated with that in code. You can drag and drop that in there and say, okay, well, this is where this lives. And you can say, well, because this component lives within company.web, for example, the only things that this component can talk to are the company.business.surrogate in this case. So you can actually set up rules associated to your code based on the architecture layer diagram. Very powerful if you think about it. Again, thinking about things such as, the developer saying, okay, well, I gotta get information from the database, so I create this method, I create the ADO.net, helper associated with it, or an ODBC connection, whatever it is that you might have. So you have your code, and then you go directly to the database with your query. Well, chances are that's gonna break a few architectural rules because, and one of the things that I advocated when I was an architect was you should always have a data access layer.
Of course.
Because you abstract the database from it, if changes happen.
Architecture
within,
101.
Yeah, if you change the database schema in any way, you're gonna break code, so create
Take
a data
the database
access
to
layer.
The cloud.
Yeah, there you go, right? So all these different things, make sure that you, if you're architecting it, you can architect it the way your system should work, and then you can validate the code associated with it, and that's what we're going to talk about.
And you know what fascinates me, too, is that many times what happens is that you're so wrapped up in things that you don't actually do the validation afterwards.
Yeah.
So that, to me,
exactly.
It's good to know, but it's one of those features that nobody does because the perception that it takes too long. Yep. And here we're just like click and we're good.
Yeah.
Right.
So maybe a little longer than that, but
you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Right. It's just, it's one of those things that I always shudder because people don't naturally want to do that.
Yep. Exactly.
Or think they don't have time to do, I should say.
That too, for sure. So, I skipped over generate dependencies because that's areas where you can say, basically, I'm going to generate the dependencies based on, you can find out where your code is actually talking to all these various different things already, so you can find out exactly what's out of whack, for example. But even validate your architecture. So before you actually release to the next environment, whether that's QA or user acceptance testing, or if it's production even, right? Before you actually push that code out, specifically from a dev environment to the next level of QA that you might have, you can actually just, right-click on the solution, bring it up in Visual Studio, go to your architecture tab, validate the architecture based on the layer diagram, and it'll give you a report as to what's actually out of whack, right? So what's breaking the rules, so you can find out right away. And the great thing about that is you can find out, fix it right away, Maybe remind the developer who did the wrong thing that, you know, that it has to go this way, that way type of thing, so that people learn in the process as well. It's always a big deal. And beyond that, it doesn't have to be a manual process. In fact, you can enforce things at build. So if you have a build process built in TFS, for example, you can actually have a gated check-in that actually does a check on the layer diagram before it actually checks in the code. So even before you promote to a different environment, you can actually say, okay, Mr. Developer or Miss Developer, if you're actually pushing code to the source code repository, before I let you actually successfully complete that check-in, we're going to do a layer diagram check automatically so that we don't have to worry about doing this type of stuff and having code that's faulty from an architectural standpoint into the system. So very valuable stuff right there.
Absolutely.
All right. Oop. Not thank you. I do want to show you some of this stuff.
I was going to say, I'm like, Paul.
Yeah. So
where's all the goods?
We got some time.
Let's show the goods. Everybody wants to see Visual Studio in action.
So I'm just going to bring my.
There you go. Let's get your screen up here.
Okay. You tell me when.
There we go.
All right. So what we have here is Visual Studio. Now, by the way, just so you know, the architectural tools that I'm going to show you are in Visual Studio Ultimate. So if you don't have the Ultimate SKU, you will not see this little component right here, the architectural tab. That's because, you know, it's a very valuable component of Visual Studio, so it's in the top line SKU. So just be aware of that. If you do want to try this stuff out, though, you can always go to visualstudio.com. And you can download the trial and try it out there. So just be aware of that. So I've already loaded a sample project, the Tailspin Toys Reference Architecture project. And by the way, you may notice I'm actually inside a virtual machine. This is, if you're familiar with any sort of ALM project or webcast that you might have seen on Channel 9, or if you've seen me do things, the Brian Keller virtual machine, which is freely downloadable, is basically a self-encapsulated virtual machine with all the Visual Studio ALM capabilities already installed and configured with some sample projects and stuff like that. So if you want to play around with this stuff, I think it's aka.ms/WAC ALM VMs.
Of course, what he's also forgetting to tell you is that if you happen to have an MSDN subscription, you can do all of this in Azure too.
You can, but this is this is already pre-configured and stuff like that. Yeah. So you cannot put this in Azure from a licensing standpoint. Just be aware of that. Okay, I just want to.
And an FYI, this is like this is like a 5 gig download, isn't it?
It's a 50 gig
download. 50 gig download. So if you don't want to download 50 gigs, Azure's a really good solution for that. You just have to set it up yourself.
Set it up yourself. Yes, absolutely. So just be aware of that.
I had to put that in there.
It's absolutely true. So if you want to play around with this stuff, definitely do that. So we're in Visual Studio 2013 Ultimate. And as you can see here, we have the Visual Studio solution up for Tailspin Toys. Now, the first thing I'm going to show you is I'm going to go here. And if I go to Windows, you'll see the Architecture Explorer. So the Architecture Explorer comes up. And let's see if we can make this a little bit bigger so it's more fun for everybody to see. So if you remember, we have, from the screenshots, we have, you know, Tailspin Toys. We can take a look at the class view. So if I take a look here, I'll just bring that back. Now here you see the class view. Now it's actually bringing me the namespaces. And I can even do something, say, for example, if I want to say, web, do a search for web and filter on that, on namespaces, for example, click OK. And I'm not sure why that's not doing anything. There we go. That's better. You can see tailspin.web. So you can filter down things, which makes it a lot easier for you to find stuff if you know what you're looking for example. And here you see, for example, now so we have the class view of the solution to the namespaces. Now we're actually going to get into the actual classes. So in this case, you can see, for example, well, let's take a look at the controller. Why not, right? So this is an MVC application. We're going to take a look at the controller. There you can see a whole bunch of methods and properties and attributes and things like that. So you can see all this stuff, and it provides you with all sorts of things like that. So if I actually click on this, say, for example, tailspin.web, I can take a look here, and I can say, for example, create a new graph from the selected nodes. So I can actually click on this. And it's going to create the graph. So I'm going to make this a little smaller now. So as you can see right here, It's not showing you a whole lot here. It's still doing its thing, for example. So there's not a whole lot that we can do here, for example. So we'll just leave that be. And what I can do here is I can say, for example, should you be able to show me related and things like that. But what I can do is I can right-click on this and see all the various different things. So I can go to the definition of Tailspin Toys, for example, and I'll bring up the code. So just wait for it to show up. And for whatever reason, it's deciding not to do much with me. So let's actually, we'll exit that. And the layout, you can even do things. So for example, all the various different, if you want to take a look at it from right to left, you can do that as well. I don't know why this isn't showing up properly. So we'll just ignore that and we'll exit that. So that's one of the things that you can do around the Architectural Explorer. But what I can also do here, for example, is I can create a dependency graph from the solution. So this is basically the code map. So if I actually go from solution here, and it's going to take a little bit of time, so just bear with me. So it's actually building the solution. So what's happening here is it's actually compiling the solution so I can actually do all this stuff and figure out exactly all the dependencies. Then it's going to index the code and actually build the graph. So we'll let that go for a little bit. So there's lots of really interesting things that we'll see here in a second. But beyond that, while we're doing that, I'm actually going to go to the solution itself, and we already got a few of these things already built, a few of these models. So you can see here, for example, if I take a look, there's a whole bunch of models here. So I can even take a look at, for example, the layer diagram. So if I double click on the layer diagram, you can see here, this is the architecture that we've actually built for this specific Tailspin Toys. So you can see, for example, there's, the web layer, which has helpers and such, and then we have a controller for the MVC, and then a model. So I can actually do things like right-click on this, and I can add a new layer if I wanted to. So say, for example, you had things such as, typical name for it would be cross-cutting things. So if you wanted to add things like security or, whatever it is that you might have and whatever. So you can do all that kind of stuff too. I'll exit that. We don't need that. But you can also take a look at this and right-click on this. You can even do things such as validate the architecture. So remember what I was saying before. So say, for example, before you actually check in code, or if you want to promote this code to a different, into a QA build or a QA environment, for example, you could do that. So if I actually click on this, validate architecture, basically what's going to happen is it's going to go through all the code that you saw here, and it's going to analyze the project. And again, we'll let this go for a little bit because it's a fairly large project. And as you can see here, it's now starting to build. And it's going to generate a report as to whether I'm in compliance or not from this project standpoint. So that's obviously something that's very, very interesting as well. So while this is actually building, let's go back to the assembly dependencies here. There we go. So you can see now that we've actually created this the dependency graph on all the various different DLLs that have actually been compiled. So that's kind of cool. Now you can zoom in and out. So if you have a wheel mouse, you can zoom in and out if you want. And in this case, I'm using my trackpad and stuff, so you can do that. We'll see if we can get in a little bit more. But you can see also here, we have a whole bunch of things. Now, what's interesting is I'm using Update 3 for Visual Studio 2013. So the reason why this is important is because one of the things that we've added within Update 3 for Visual Studio 2013 is a color coding of some of your relationships. So if you go on Legend here, for example, you can see, for example, you can see there's green and pink. Hopefully it shows up on your screen. But you can see, for example, there's calls from different things are in pink, and you have inheritance, so object-oriented inheritance and stuff like that as well. So whether it's like this, this API is calling that API, or whether you're actually inheriting and creating a super class of a different type of class and all that kind of stuff. And the other thing that's interesting is that the weight of the arrows shows exactly how many of these types of things are existing within those. So I can even do things such as, for example, if I go to tailspin.model, I can actually expand this, and as it just expands, there you can see there's the different namespaces. So if I go to tailspin.model, wait for this to show up, and then obviously this is getting quite large, so we'll see if we can zoom in a little bit here. So dragging this stuff over, you can see different properties and whatever else and things like that. And I can even take a look here, for example, create the graph layout. and there's the resources. So you get all this information right here. Now, the other thing that's interesting is I can even take a look at, for example, all these various different things. So if I click on this, I get information on the specific relationships. In this case, these are calls, or inherits from. So external would be, for example, the .NET framework and things like that. So if you're actually using, you know, the string class and all that kind of stuff, those would be considered external because you didn't build them yourself. So you get all these things here and you can find out some information. And one of the things that's a little bit tricky is you can actually get a little bit of information from this if the arrow for my mouse is actually put at the right spot. It's a little bit of a pain in the butt sometimes to do here. Let's see if we can do it on this one instead. You get some arrows and stuff like that that show up within this call. Yeah, it's not behaving properly here. So basically, you can get some further information here. So let's see if I can do this one. Yeah, it's not be doing enough for me to show you here. Okay, well, we'll let that go for now. But you know, hopefully, yeah, I'm trying to go on the arrow, and sometimes it gives you more information. Yeah, there we go. That's what I was looking for. So you can click the center button to get more information on this link. So if I click on this, it actually will bring up more information. And basically what it's doing, it's querying all the contributing links. So you can get all the information on this specific links associated with that. So you can get even more information. So we'll let that go. And as you can see here, when we actually did all this stuff, you can see all the various different code analysis. And you can see all those various different things that are associated with this that might be a problem with the architecture. So you can see all these types of things, and you can make some changes on the layer diagram as well. So very, very valuable when you're actually trying to figure out some of this stuff. Now, as I said before as well, you can also do some things like annotate some of this stuff. So if I want to, I can add, for example, and for whatever reason, it's taking a little bit of time, I can add things such as a comment, for example. So I can add a comment and say, need to look at the controller a little more carefully, whatever, right? You know, whatever it is that you need to do. And you can, for example, say for here, I can right click and I can create a work item. So in this case, say for example, it's a new, a new feature associated with it. So I can basically add a new feature into TFS, in this case, because that's what I'm linked to here, enter in a new feature and provide implementation details, all the typical things that you would see when you're actually creating a new work item or whatever it is within TFS. You can all do that, and it's all linked in. And that will be linked into the diagram so that, you know, when you find out all the various different sort of links, it'll actually have a link to the specific diagram itself. In this case, you can see right here, it's actually linked automatically to the diagram. So if you wanted to get more information about that, you can double click on this. And if you're using Visual Studio Ultimate, you can actually go right directly to the diagram to get this. So there's lots of great things there as well. I'm not going to save this. But you can even do things such as, for example, take a look at the properties. And you can see here all the various different things around this. But it's all available to you. And you can say, for, you know, you can highlight things as well. So the typical things that you would think you could do or want to do, you can absolutely do. And you can do things such as generate the dependencies, and like I talked about as well. So all sorts of really interesting things there. Now, say for example, you know, this is all stuff that you've done, but say for example you wanted to create a new one. You can actually create a new file, new project, for example. And if we take a look here, and we go to modeling projects, you can see there's all sorts of different modeling projects that we can create. So I'm just going to create a new one. I'm not going to bother saving what I just showed you because it's not really important to the actual project itself. So here we have, you know, the model definition and the layer references. Now what I can do here is I can actually add a new diagram. So if I do new item, and in this case, as you can see here, all the various different diagrams. So I can actually add, for example, a use case diagram, for example. So I'll just call this use case diagram. And you can see right here, we have the toolbox. So what I can do is I can add an actor, right? So there's actor one, and we'll name him Jonathan.
Ooh, I feel special now.
Right? And we'll add another actor, drag him over here, and we'll name him the other guy.
AKA Paul.
AKA Paul. Just to be completely explicit about it. And then we can create a use case, for example. So here's a use case. And the use case here is discusses, you know, or no, we could say the use case is architecture. And then you can create, for example, an association or a dependency or whatever. You can do all those types of things as well. So in this case, we can say Jonathan is associated to the architecture component. And say, for example, I could say I'm a dependency on it because I'm actually showing the pieces and whatever else. And then you can add some features and functionality. I can say demos architecture.
It's almost like you're making a use case for how we do Breakpoint.
It's kind of a point, yeah. So you can do all these types of things as well. So there's that. Now, some of the other things you can do, for example, I can create a new diagram even from the architecture tab. And say, for example, I wanted to create, let's just say, a sequence diagram, because those are kind of cool, right? So you could say, for example, and again, go to the toolbox. And as you can see here, the toolboxes are contextually sensitive to whatever type of diagram you're doing. So a sequence diagram, if you're familiar with it or not familiar with it, I should say, is basically exactly what you might imagine. It's basically when something happens, what is the sequence of events that makes it actually happen, right? So what we have here is a lifeline. I've always wondered why they call them these things. This makes it sound so dire, I tell you.
It's like back from, what was that show on TV with the lifeline? Who Wants to Be a Millionaire?
Oh, yeah.
Right?
Yeah, that's right.
You get to call a lifeline.
Yeah.
So there you go, same thing. It effectively means the same. Now, the question is, who came up with it first? That's a different story.
Exactly.
That's a different story.
So you can see here, for example, we can create a synchronous, create a synchronous event here in message one. We could say, for example, let's call lifeline one. We'll call this record setup. And this one could be demo. Okay. And then, for example, this message could be put together infrastructure, which if you could see from the camera is an awful lot, and I'm worried about radiation damage, but you know, that's just the way it is. And then you could say, for example, once the record setup is done, you could say, for example, I'm gonna create a synchronous component. So basically what happens is the synchronous component is now happening, and I can create this and put this synchronous component and create a new, say for example, here. And as you can see here, I've created a synchronous component. I can say create whatever, and we could say create conversation, which in turn creates ideas, right? So you get that back and forth and everything else like that. So this is a very simple and very dumb example, but you get the idea of, you know, okay, you have the Breakpoint episode and you want to create ideas to the audience. So this is an example of how you might be able to do some of this stuff.
So the crazy part about all of this is that, yes, it's, you know, it's, at the end of the day, it's UML. Fine.
Yep.
Great. But when I think back to the way it was before all these tools were built in, like these are all additional tools that, let's say, Visio can do it, but let's say you specifically wanted a UML editor to do.
Yep.
So that's more software that you're buying.
Yep.
And then somehow you have to associate it with your project, and then somehow you have to associate it with what the code you're actually building and stuff like that.
Yep.
So to me, yes, it's cool that it's integrated, mm-hmm. but the extent to which it's integrated is the part that is what's fascinating about it, because then you can actually, everything that you're building here, everything that you saw Paul put on the screen, then actually translates into code afterwards.
Exactly, right.
Right? So it's not just a diagramming tool built into Visual Studio, if that's what you're thinking.
Yeah, exactly. So what I can also do, for example, and I'm going to add a new project here very quickly, and I know we're running a little bit out of time, so we'll...
Which, of course, if you guys have ever been on a Breakpoint episode before, happens every month.
Yes,
but that's
it
because
does.
I don't want to stop the goodness that comes in, so... Plus, everybody can use a little bit longer of a lunch on a Friday.
Yeah, exactly. So we're going to create a console app just for the heck of it. OK, So what we have here is we have the console app that we've created, and you know, it's pretty simple, nothing there. What I can do, the one thing I want to show you here is the fact that I created that code map, for example, and it was very, very complicated and things like that, and I generated that from the top level. I can actually right click on this and I can say show on code map right from this. So you can see, for example, we have a C# file in this case, we have the console application, show on code map, and it's actually going to create the code map right from there. So the program class is right there. And as you can imagine, there's nothing in this, but you could say, for example, all the various different things. You have your main method, and then you have the program method and all that kind of stuff, right? So
insert awesome clapping here.
Yeah, exactly, right? So it's scoped as well. So you don't have to, you know, how big that project was getting when I showed Tailspin Toys around the code map. Gets unreadable after a while, right? So you can even do things directly from a specific scope if that's something that you're looking for as well. So I just wanted to show all those types of things and really sort of drive home the fact that, you know, like all these things are available to you. If you're using this for .NET or C++ on Visual Studio, there's lots of goodness that can integrate directly into the code itself. Mm-hmm. If you're using Java or Ruby or PHP and things like that, that are not necessarily Visual Studio first class citizens, I guess you could say from a language perspective inside the IDE specifically, you can still use this to help model your applications.
I don't think you had enough qualifiers in there.
Well,
but it's
first
true.
First class citizen
it's
probably
true.
Isn't the right word. That's why I sort of want to qualify. But yeah, it's, you know, just because you can't code Java necessarily really well within a Visual Studio because, you know, the facilities aren't quite there for various reasons, which we will not get into. But doesn't mean you can't use the tooling associated with it.
So that's actually one of the questions that I often get from developers who are and architects that are playing around with this stuff, mm-hmm. is whether there's still a purpose of doing it in Visual Studio, even though, let's say, your project is a hybrid project and you're not just doing .NET.
Yeah, yeah.
And I mean, usually the answer I give them is, if for nothing else, the built-in check-in into TFS or whatever for the source control or the source control for the asset makes it worthwhile doing it.
Yeah, and I think it's really interesting, you know, we talk about this and things are getting more complicated, right? So things aren't getting simpler. That's true all the time, right? So I look back and when I first started with Jeff McHugh and Derek Ellingwood, right? You know, like that was fairly simple compared to what I see today in systems, right? You know, we were working on a web project and it was CGI project. So we were building C++ that generated a spew of HTML and stuff like that on the fly and all that kind of stuff. Yeah, it was awesome.
It's good to know that we have much easier ways of doing it these days.
Yeah, right. Well, it's easier, but it's also, there's more to it, right?
True.
So from a security
standpoint.
I said
easier, I didn't say less complex.
Yeah, yeah. So it's a good point, yeah. So the intent here is to provide you with the tooling that allows you to get that stuff done more quickly, more efficiently, to find out how to build out your applications a little bit more quickly as well. And the architecture tools help with that. In fact, you know, you take a look and you see, you know, the world has changed to cloud. You know, you have cloud, you have on-premise, you have a bit of both. You know, how do you architect those types of things and how do you make them work together? Well, you know what? Some of these things can help with that. You're building mobile applications. Guess what? There's two major sort of platforms today, an Android and iOS, and then we have Windows that's, you know, an up-and-comer, you know, all those types of things. And, you know, we have great partners like Xamarin, if you're familiar with it. You can actually use C#, you know, to create these applications for iOS and Android. Well, the architectural tools work just fine with those two because they work in Visual Studio. So,
and you know what? Even though we didn't get into it, because obviously a lot of the architecture tools that we focused on today are more development-oriented, but there are actual capabilities in there as well to look at solutions more holistically and look at infrastructure and stuff like that too. Not from a building and automation perspective, but just so that, you know, think about it, if you're building web services and whatever, you want to make sure that certain constraints are respected and whatever. All of that exists in there as well.
Absolutely. And in fact, we have a very mature group at this point called the Patterns and Practices group.
Yep.
I highly encourage you to do a search for Patterns & Practices with space in between.
Yeah, Jack, I think there's actually a very simple URL.
It might be, right?
Microsoft.com/PNP, I believe.
It could be, right? Let's see here.
Nope.
Guess not.
I'll post it into the chat.
Yeah, okay. So Patterns and Practices is basically a set of guidance for building out very solid architectural patterns for web projects, for desktop applications, for mobile applications, for cloud applications, whatever it is that you need, and how you sort of interact with those things. In fact, you know, how do you build out, you know, a productivity solution like Office 365, for example, and how do you integrate that in? All sorts of stuff. There's lots of great information there that can help you. And in fact, unfortunately, it's not in Visual Studio 2013, but it is in Visual Studio 2010, believe it or not. It's a Patterns and Practices group. Actually, some of the publications they have around things like the web and things like that, they recommend a set of layers, you know, the architecture, the tiers of the architecture for a web application, for example. They've translated that into a set of templates for the layer diagrams, for example, that allow you to make use of those best practices already so you can drag and drop your methods and classes and stuff.
I can
like
say
that
firsthand, back when I was doing it, we used those templates.
Yeah, they're fantastic.
Not only are they fantastic, but huge time saver. Right?
Yeah.
So, I mean, and they're enforcing a lot of standards. And by the way, for each one of those templates, there's also an accompanying book. So granted, the templates themselves aren't available for 2013, but the book is still out there and the patterns themselves are still valid.
Exactly. And that's really the point, right? It's the fact that, okay, yeah, maybe we're not quite up to speed on the Visual Studio 2013 side of things about creating the template for you. The templates are not that hard to sort of figure out.
Right.
You can create them very, very quickly, probably within 10 minutes, and then you can drag and drop and drag and drop and drag and drop all the different pieces of code associated with it.
Cool.
Yeah.
So does that mean that we've done the full circle?
Yes, so the slide that said thank you that I accidentally showed, thank you.
I mean, you realize that that was like half an hour ago.
I know, but that's good because I wanted to get through some of this demo stuff, right? So,
So of course, as per the usual with Breakpoint, we do a whirlwind tour about a whole bunch of different things. We're going to keep the chat open as we usually do for probably a good another 15, 20 minutes or so. If you have a specific question for Paul and I, by all means, please put that on the chat. Or again, if you're watching on demand, then you can put it in the comments underneath the video. Now, for next episode. So this is September 19th. Mark it on your calendars right now. September 19th, same time.
2014. For those of you that are watching on Channel 9, not
yeah,
live.
Fair enough. I was going to say, I'm pretty sure we're all in the same year, maybe different time zones, but so 12 p.m. Eastern on September the 19th, and I believe we're talking all about data, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes.
You going to give us a little bit more?
Really?
Did you notice how every month he likes to be so mysterious about these things?
Yes, absolutely.
Keeps going back.
We're going to talk a little bit about some of the integration capabilities within Visual Studio around data, specifically SQL Server. So the SQL Server data tooling and some of the great features around how you can use Visual Studio to make your SQL Server data really pop.
Yeah, and that one's fascinating to me as well, just because I remember back in the day, we would always have Visual Studio open, we'd always have SQL Server Management Studio open, and you can never really get them to talk to each other, and the SQL Server stuff that was in Visual Studio was not spectacular. All that's changed now. It's like a whole new world for developers specifically using SQL Server. Yeah. And actually SQL Server on a VM in Azure, if you're doing it that way. And there's a bit of stuff in there too for, what is it now? The Azure SQL databases or whatever. They changed the name.
Yeah,
on
I still call
month.
It SQL Azure just because I think that sounds cool. But,
yeah, I still call it Windows Azure SQL, Windows SQL Azure. No, Windows Azure SQL databases. Who came up with that name? I don't know. But you tried demoing that multiple times.
Yeah, exactly.
Anyway, on that note, hopefully we'll see you September 19th. Thanks again for joining in.
Thank you.
As per the usual, we'll have the show up on Channel 9 probably within a week or so. So feel free to tune in then. Follow us on CDN Devs, hashtag Breakpoint.ca, and that way you'll actually know when the show is up. And until then,
have a great month. We'll see you next month.
Yeah, and then hopefully we'll be in the pool in September, which will be ironic, but
yeah,
hey, why not?
Pool party at my place.
When you can. All right, guys, take care.
Have a good one.
Oh, and
happy coding. Happy architecting.
I was going to say, I'm like, did we not just finish talking about architecture?
Yeah.
Okay, anyways, we can rant on for a while. See you later.